Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
He would appear in the dark.
Handing, literally handing.
He was a killer.
World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
As plantas dos pássaros, a gente ouve o canto dos pássaros. A gente consegue sentir.
We hear the birds singing. We can feel the breeze, feel the freshness of the forest. We can feed ourselves from the forest, from what it produces, from hunting, from birds.
Welcome to Brazil.
My name is Josenildo. I am chief of the Munduruku people in Pará, municipality of Santarém.
The Pará region is home to indigenous tribes and also big agribusiness.
Agribusiness for us doesn't bring the wealth and development that is so often reported by the big media. It only brings destruction, only misery. For us, the forest and the land are something mystical. For them, the land is only valuable if it can produce what they want.
This is Fed, with me, Chris Van Tulleken. I'm investigating why we eat the food we eat and at what cost. I'm telling the story of our complicated relationship with a bird that illustrates our approach to food perhaps better than anything else. A bird whose influence has spread around the world, from your local supermarket to the Amazon rainforest. This is Series 1, Planet Chicken. Welcome to Episode 7, Big Chicken. I'm trying to get to grips with the power of the multi-billion dollar chicken industry and its imprint around the world. Over the last few weeks, I've learned how most of our chicken meat is raised, using an indoor farming system that appears to be a triumph of efficiency and food security. It's been rolled out all over the world. But whilst there are benefits, there are also costs to animals, to the environment, to the food itself, and even the people producing it. And I wonder if some are paying a disproportionate price. We'll come back to Brazil. First, I want to get a handle on the power of big chicken.
Let me say that today there are about 25 billion chicken in this planet, about 3 birds per person.
Talking over a crackly Zoom line from Rome is Ugo Pica Chiamara. He's a livestock economist at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. His job is to help countries improve their farming and food security, and he knows a lot about chicken.
Poultry is particularly efficient at transforming feed into protein. And it can be grown basically everywhere, regardless of the agroecological conditions, so whether it's hot or cold, or whether it rains or dry. And it contributes little to greenhouse gas emissions.
And this is the crux of the whole argument for chicken as the world's animal protein champion. It's got the smallest footprint.
Per kilo of protein, chicken are the cleanest source of animal protein for humans. And in general, about 50 to 60% of emissions can be associated to feed production. Now, I guess here we should ask ourselves, what would be the alternative use of the land if we stopped producing feed for chicken?
Ugo's making an important point, one that's often left out of environmental discussions. What's the alternative if we don't grow chicken feed? Some say we should do something completely different, like plant crops for humans to eat. But rightly or wrongly, we have a growing world population that wants to eat more meat. We can't get enough of it. So if we compare the environmental footprint of feed for chickens to feed for pigs or cattle, Ugo is unequivocal.
Chickens are the cleanest and more efficient way of producing animal protein for humans. An additional 1.8 million people will live in this world in the next 15 years, so I think that in such a context, really, poultry has a bright future.
Chicken's starting to sound like the protein poster child in the fight against world hunger. But make no mistake, we're still talking about a serious global commodity. Yes, it's feeding people all around the world, but it's also generating a massive amount of money in the process. And that's where the poultry giants come in, massive global firms serving a growing demand. These companies are titans at the apex of the food chain, And after weeks of asking, negotiating, cajoling, pleading and begging with various international corporate teams, it seemed like every single one of the world's top 10 poultry players had flatly turned down our requests for interviews. But just as my producer and I were about to give in, one of the big ones stepped up. I can't hear you. Now I can. It's very nice to see you. Hans, thanks so much. We've got you till 5:30, is that right?
That's right.
Amazing. Could you just
Hans Cabat is Cargill's president of protein for North America. He's kind of a big deal.
Do you mind a personal question? What's your favorite protein? Do you eat beef, eggs, chicken?
Well, I do love chicken. I also grew up on a beef operation in Michigan, and my dad now raises bison. So I also.
Now here's the thing you might find weird about all this, because I do. Cargill are one of the biggest chicken companies you've never heard of. Like the rest of the world's major meat providers, they're not front of house. They sell their products to other companies, public-facing brands that we buy from every day. If you eat chicken, you've almost certainly eaten Cargill's chicken. You just would never know about it.
So I am, like our business, I'm a multi-protein lover.
That's quite a niche answer. You're my first bison-loving contributor.
I asked Hans, since lots of people haven't heard of you, what do we need to know about Cargill?
The first thing to know about us is that we're more than 155 years old, and we're really driven by our purpose of nourishing the world in a safe, responsible, and sustainable way. We have a team of 68,000 people across Latin America, North America, Asia, and Europe, producing enough protein to feed about 170 million people every day.
And when it comes to selling this chicken, what are the priorities for your customers?
Affordability, because that's what they need to face their customers with. Another is convenience, and that really is true across the world right now.
This is something we've heard before. Consumers want their chicken cheap and convenient. In which case, who shoulders the responsibility for the environmental footprint? I want to know if Hans thinks that Cargill can keep producing more and more chicken and turning a profit without destroying the planet.
Yes, I believe we can. There are complex problems, for sure, but we honestly believe that the role that we play in a large and complex global agricultural system is part of the solution. Yes, we're a business. A business is finely tuned at making the most efficient use of resources. And sometimes we make some money and sometimes we don't make money. Obviously, we want to make money more than we lose money, but we're here. And these are tough markets.
They are tough markets. Cargill Inc.'s most recent results across their whole business, not just chicken, saw profits drop 43%, down to $3.81 billion. That's apparently due to things like rising costs linked to the Ukraine war. Still, $3.8 billion is not to be sniffed at. It's a timely reminder that individuals may have all sorts of different motivations, but most companies' primary obligation has to be to their bottom line. And here's where we come back to Brazil, partly because it's one of the world's biggest chicken producers, but also because it grows the soybeans and cereals that sell as commercial poultry feed. And Cargill, well, they've got a stake in that too.
Right now, Cargill supplies what we call triple S soy, which is verified as being deforestation free, and Cargill has made a commitment for all of our production in Brazil to be deforestation free in 2025.
Pledges around boycotting crops from deforested land feel like progress, and it's a step that companies like Cargill have had to take because the world is starting to sit up and ask questions. Even with the feed I'm giving my own chickens, the bag proudly states that it doesn't use any soy from Brazil. From a business perspective, I can see that integrating chicken and feed production makes sense. And as Hans points out, this model is feeding millions. But something's still nagging away at me. The idea that countries like Brazil might be paying too high a price to keep the rest of us in wings. Brazil's the world's top soybean exporter, and although the crop can be used in a whole load of different ways, it mostly goes for animal feed. Deforestation to clear the way for agriculture has happened all over the world. But Brazil is one of the worst affected countries, with huge amounts of rainforest destroyed by people who want more farmland.
Agora, Yay, cacique.
This is Leonardo Milano. He's a photojournalist and filmmaker who reports on stories from the people and environment of the Brazilian Amazon. Today he's working with us and he's driven out to rural Planalto to meet José Nildo, chief of the Munduruku people. José Nildo is not only chief, he's also a teacher and campaigner for indigenous rights. He speaks out regularly against the soy industry. Now, big companies say they're making positive progress in the battle against deforestation and all the associated problems. So we've asked Leonardo to find out if that progress is being felt on the ground. He asked José Nildo when tensions first arose between the Munduruku people and soybean producers.
The introduction of soybeans started in 2002. When they first arrived, they were friends, they came here to help. And then the relationship started changing. They started using a lot of chemical pesticides. And then the animals started dying. Animals belonging to local residents living near the plantations. Chickens, ducks, turkeys, and our bean, corn, and rice crops stopped producing as they used to.
It might sound counterintuitive that pesticides can stop crops growing. The problem is that overuse can kill off not just target pests, but all nearby insect life, which then has knock-on effects for biodiversity, pollination, and natural pest control. And it's not just plants and animals that are affected. Pesticides used on soy in the Americas have been linked to birth defects and much higher cancer rates among local populations.
When our people started questioning this situation, the soy farmers started retaliating. They wanted to stop us from even traveling on a road, and things kept escalating day by day to the point where we faced more explicit and formal threats.
Leonardo says that when he arrived, a woman asked him why he was there, and she sounded really scared. When he said it was for our interview, this woman visibly relaxed. She said that she thought he might have come to hurt José Nildo.
That's how we live now. The way they treat both the environment and us is getting worse every day. We have misery here, we have pollution, we have diseases, we have violence. And where does the wealth go? Where does the richness go? It doesn't go to us.
As it happens, I visited the Pará region before. I was investigating a floating supermarket that delivered convenience and junk foods to people across the Amazon region, where, strangely enough, obesity rates were rising. I'm reminded of the common criticism I heard then about big transnational brands exporting their operations to the Americas, and indeed other parts of the world. That while any harms they cause are felt locally, the profit usually goes elsewhere, often to the global north to be distributed to shareholders. I wonder what Cargill's Hans Cabat makes of all this. Hans, I'm uncomfortable asking this question, but I hope it's a fair one, because Cargill is occasionally in the headlines. We've heard from a Brazilian who said that soy farmers who supply Cargill are expanding their businesses by taking indigenous territories. They've been threatening people who live there, spraying pesticides over the crops that contaminate rivers. There are knock-on effects on biodiversity. Do you recognize those descriptions, and how robust is the due diligence on all those suppliers?
You know, that's an area that I'm just not an expert in. I'm happy to refer you on to somebody in Cargill, but I'm not going to have the right answer for you.
Fair enough. We'll follow that up. Back with José Nildo, Leonardo points out that soybean farmers say they're doing nothing wrong. They're providing food, wealth, and jobs for the region. But the chief insists something deeper is going on with this industry, something illegal.
Producers are actually growing illegally and passing on their crops via these supposedly illegal producers to companies like Cargill. In such a way, this irregular soy gets into illegal supply chains.
As it happens, this problem has been reported on. In 2021, an investigation by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in partnership with Greenpeace, Reporter Brazil and The Guardian used satellite images and enforcement records to show that soya was being illegally planted on land that the government had ordered out of production because it breached deforestation laws. The report claimed this was evidence of soy laundering and that the resulting crop was being sold through approved farms to international companies, not only, but including Cargill. This sounds an awful lot like what Jos Enildo is saying now. So I went back to the team at Cargill and put this to them. They told me that they investigated these allegations following the 2021 report and confirmed their suppliers in Brazil were not purchasing any soya from the farms linked with this illegal practice. In response to those earlier claims I put to Hans about soy farmers threatening indigenous people, harming the environment by spraying pesticides, the team at Cargill came back with a written statement on that too. My producer Lucy has it in front of her. Lucy, what does it say?
Well, they told me that Cargill only sources grains from producers in compliance with all laws in the countries where they do business. They said they have robust procedures to ensure they're respecting social and environmental restrictions and that they won't source soy from regulated indigenous areas. They also said they've just completed tracing 100% of their directly sourced soy in Brazil back to the farm level using polygon mapping, which is basically where you use GPS to trace a farm's boundaries and then confirm where they're growing actually matches up to that.
And what if there are violations?
Then they will block that farm from their supply chain. They also pointed out that they do have a grievance process in place. So anyone can bring a claim against a farm for violations around sustainable soy or human rights. Apparently, under that scheme, they've already blocked 376 farms, and they've actually blocked an additional 209 specifically to avoid the potential problem of soy being rerouted from restricted areas.
We put Jos Enildo's claims about soy laundering and ongoing harm to nature and biodiversity to Brazil's Ministry of Environment and to the country's Soybean Producers Association. Neither of them responded to our repeated requests for a comment. There are invisible links between food production and things like loss of biodiversity, carbon emissions, pesticide pollution, harm to indigenous communities. And they shouldn't feel irrelevant when we buy fried chicken on our high streets. But for many of us, me included, out of sight means out of mind. The fact remains, this industry is changing the planet. And although some of those impacts might pass us by, there are other risks linked to industrial chicken farming that will be harder to ignore because they pose a much more direct threat to all of us.
Medicine and public health had been obsessed for several decades with telling people to use antibiotics better. But I discovered that there was a much larger use of antibiotics in agriculture that no one really seemed to be paying attention to.
Let me reintroduce Maren McKenna. She's an American journalist I've spoken to before. She's an expert in food and public health, including the problem of antimicrobial resistance. That's where overuse of antibiotics in farming helps bacteria build up resistance to the drugs supposed to control them, which can have knock-on effects when it comes to treating the same bugs in humans.
There have been efforts to suppress or block farm antibiotic use for the past couple of decades, patchily around the world, but there's still literal tons being used.
Do we know how much we are now using globally?
There is some good research that's been done in Europe, and the numbers are kind of wiggly, and the reason is because a lot of countries don't require this to be reported.
My day job is working as an infectious diseases doctor, and I know all too well that whether we end up needing a hip replacement or cancer treatment, antibiotics are central to so much of modern medicine. Antibiotic resistance could eventually hurt us all. But there's more, the threat of a possible pandemic, because it turns out that intensive agriculture, like industrial chicken farming, is the ideal incubator for viruses.
We already can see what's happening with avian flu in wild birds, right? Over the past couple of years, the damage has been just horrific. If that virus got closer to the interface between animals and humans, which is a pretty good description of what agriculture is, and adapted, we could be off to the races.
The answer for farms seems a bit obvious, just improve biosecurity. But that raises a different problem, a trade-off with bird welfare.
So biosecurity and animal welfare are really on this kind of tilting seesaw. And it's the threat of avian flu that is leaning on the biosecurity side, but possibly shutting off the welfare side as a result.
So there's a conflict between having our chickens happily roaming outdoors, mixing with other birds, and having them all locked up in a barn where they can't catch wild bird viruses.
That is a conflict.
The food security that many of us around the world take for granted is the product of this massive integrated system that has a whole range of impacts, not all of them good.
And ironically, issues caused by this system, like loss of biodiversity or viral pandemics, could ultimately lead to huge food insecurity.
But not everyone's trying to feed the world in the same way.
Let me start recording like that, huh? Okay. Yes, I'm in Addis Ababa. So
Olivier Hanot is a professor of genetics at Nottingham University. But right now, he's in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. He's working with the International Livestock Research Institute there on projects to help improve farming and food security across Africa.
In Africa today, 70% of animal proteins are actually produced by the rural farmer. They are not coming from this big international company and so on. It's actually the smallholder farmer who produce the animal food of Africa.
Olivier explains that this small farm setup is found in most low and middle-income countries on the African and Asian continents. And he doesn't think that the intensive indoor system, the one that some say can feed the world, is the right approach here.
In fact, the commercial chicken, the egg layer, or the traditional broiler will not survive on the African continent. They've really been developed for intensive production system with a lot of management intervention.
As I've seen for myself while visiting various farms, the most productive systems rely on an integrated network, abattoirs, refrigerated transport, food hygiene inspectors. That sort of setup just wouldn't be possible in all countries. So if we rule out the world's most common template for producing masses of chicken, what's the alternative?
Improve dual-purpose chicken. Breed which will produce egg and meat. And these breeds, we are actually testing them in different farmer setting, in different agroecology across Africa, and we are identifying the most suitable one. And once they are actually delivered to the farmer, they increase the production by a considerable amount. We have observed an increase in production of up to 154 eggs and 200% increase in body weights.
Olivier's solution is both obvious and radical. Chicken to suit the country of production that's already adapted to flourish there. And, even better, he thinks this localized approach could help with the antibiotics issue as well.
These birds are scavenging, and besides leftover from the kitchen or grain, they are eating insects. Actually, insects naturally produce a high diversity of antimicrobial peptides. So eating insects may trigger the immune system of the chicken and play a role in increasing resistance to bacterial infection and therefore reduce the need of using antibiotics.
In fact, Olivier predicts that insects will be the feed solution that the world is waiting for. But this is a bit of a grey area. Chickens will obviously eat insects when they're allowed, as my three demonstrate daily. But when it comes to producing insects for commercial feed, lawmakers are cautious. And that's because of concerns about spreading disease by feeding animals to other animals. But recently there has been a pushback. Processed insects for chicken feed have been legalised in the EU and some other parts of the world. In the UK, only live insects are allowed. Figuring out how to supercharge the insect industry and get production volumes anywhere near soya and what's needed to fuel the world's chicken farms is another matter altogether. But insects are an incredibly rich source of protein. And supporters believe this could be a viable, sustainable alternative. Supporters like Olivier.
I strongly believe that insects will become part of the meal of the chicken. It's already part of it at the smaller farmer level because these birds are semi-scavenging. It's natural, actually, for a chicken to eat insects. What I will argue is unnatural has been to feed the chicken on essentially a corn or soybean meal exclusively.
This global chicken story is a patchwork of good and bad, of people feeding the world, people mistreating others, people turning a profit, and people just craving more chicken. But what about the winners and losers? Who's paying a higher price to subsidise the appetites of others? Producer Lucy and I are chatting about this in my study, when disaster strikes. We hear a shout from outside where Dinah's in the garden with the girls, and we run downstairs.
What happened?
I got the fox with forks on his mouth.
Oh my god.
But I think he's already taken Layla.
You just record this, Lizzie.
I am.
Now we've only got two chickens.
know, Bug, my worry as well is how I don't think Fox is going to be very well.
It's a second fox attack. Layla's gone in a puff of feathers. Fawkes is badly injured, a broken leg, and he's bleeding from the body.
I'm not sure how kind it's going to be to keep this one alive. Oh, Fawkes, I think you might have to call the vet.
It's becoming clear what I'm going to have to do with Fawkes, and it strikes me that out of my original flock of five, there's just one left. Turns out it's not easy raising chickens. In the grand scheme of things, this is a small-scale tragedy. I can't help thinking how much worse it would be if these birds had been a vital source of food for my family, as they might be in other parts of the world. Chickens are an amazingly efficient source of animal protein. But at the same time, this massive global business has consequences, and they add up. It's almost as if the chicken industry has two identities. One as an extremely efficient industrial operation that produces tons of cheap protein for hungry people around the world. But the other ensures chicken and chicken feed remain a goldmine for the small group that controls the global chicken supply chain. And this side of the industry is having significant effects on people, animals, and environments around the world. It seems to me there are clear winners and losers. And if we care about the negative impacts, something does need to change. Because if antibiotic resistance continues to grow, or we get another viral pandemic because of the world's chicken farms, well then, we're all going to be losers. Next time, as I come to terms with my depleted flock, can I still face eating chicken?
The food industry is a very difficult beast. The 1 billion chickens that Britain eats every year, they shouldn't be eating it. They should eat less.
He was known to be a killer. Even if you see him in the town, everybody will say he's the killer.
This is the story of a man who killed so many people, he lost count. But despite his shocking death toll, he only served 12 years in jail.
It's astounding that anybody could get away with it.
And the families of his victims want justice.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.